This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And that Yisroi was moved to convert from his own religion to Judaism as a result of what he heard about the Milchemes Amalek, the war with Amalek. But that wasn't his first encounter with the Jewish people, obviously. At that point he was already well established as Moshe's father-in-law. He had married a daughter to Moshe. He was part of the family and he knew the Jewish people well. So the incident with Amalek was by no means his first contact with the Jewish people, nor his first change of heart with respect to them. You'll remember we discussed last night that Yisroi was a party to the discussions that took place at Paro's palace, among whom were himself, Yisroi, and Paro, and Amalek. And that Amalek and Yisroi took the same view. They were party to the advice to Paro to destroy the Jewish people. So Yisroi was a classical anti-Semite. There was no question about that before. Not only was he an idol worshiper and so on, but he was an anti-Semite and wanted the annihilation of the Jewish people. Together with Paro and Amalek, they all formed one grouping. The shift that takes place from that point of virulent anti-Semitism to the point of conversion to Yiddishkeit, although the point that made the act of conversion was the war of Amalek, but clearly the shift in attitude started taking place earlier. And for that we need to go back to the first encounter that Yisroi has, the first recorded encounter that Yisroi has with a Jew, which is of course his encounter with Moshe Rabbeinu. And in doing this, and this shiur really is a little bit different to the usual style. Firstly, I'm going to be using two sedras. It's going to be a shiur on Parashas Shmos and on Parashas Yisroi. And secondly, I'm going to explore with you the whole approach, or at least an angle of the approach of the Torah to nationalism, to racism, to stereotyping, to relationships within a nation and to relationships across national relationships. By way of introduction to that, and in order also to show its relevance to our understanding of circumstances in our own immediate environment, I'm going to first of all introduce you to a problem that we deal with in this country quite a lot. And it's a problem that that in the Institute of Business Ethics I've become very involved in, because it's a problem that has disturbed business for many years and to which they haven't yet found a solution. And that is the simple situation that you'll find in a business, that you can have a man who's worked there for a long time, a black man, who's worked in the company for a long time, and he sees another black man steal. The tendency is that the first black man will not report the second black man, irrespective of how long he's worked there, irrespective of how good the company has been to him. If he knows that there's theft going on, he will not report it. He'll keep quiet about it. Of course, the only way that the companies get to grips with the such crimes is by reporting. And that kind of theft, not only do they not report it, but sometimes they even assist in it. And this, apart from being destructive in terms of a business situation, is additionally destructive in terms of racial relationships, because that leads white people to say, quite understandably, well, black people are dishonest, they steal. And you can't rely on them, you can't trust them. So we've been asked to have a look at this and to deal with this and to work out what's happening, and we've found some interesting things based on Chazal. Let's have a look at three cases that Moshe Rabbeinu handles in dealing with conflict. And the Sipurna points out that these three cases are racially different in the way they're constructed. Let's have a look at them. The last one was the one with Yisro's daughters. Moshe comes to the well. Vayavoyu haroyim vayagoshim. Moshe watches the young girls, Yisro's daughters, come to the well first. So they have the first right to take water from it. And the big, bulky male shepherds come along and they chase them away. Vayoko Moshe vayoshion. Now picture the situation. Moshe is living in a foreign land. Not only is it not Eretz Israel, but it's not even his own country. It's not even Mitzrayim. So the equivalent would be of one of us standing in the street in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in Korea, anywhere. And we're standing there and we're watching. Some young ladies come to a shop or whatever it is, and some old bigger people come along and push them aside, and they get served first. What would we do? We have a few options. We could do nothing. So they'll wait a little bit, they'll come later, nothing to do. We can say it's none of our business. That's probably what we would say. That's not what Moshe did. Vayokim Moshe vayoshiyan. Vayash getzoyim. Moshe involves himself. It's all going. The shepherds are going. Yisro's daughters are going. What's it going to do with him? He chases them away. And he helps them water their flock. And they say thank you and disappear. Says the Sipurna, "Bihayos shnei ba'alei hariv nochrim." Since the two sides in the argument in this case were non-Jews, loy hisoyreil lihinakim, he made no effort to punish the one, to punish the roim, the shepherds. Gam loy hikpid liyasher or choson, and nor did he try and give them musar. He didn't get involved in an educational process. Betoychachus musar. He regarded his only function as being to save the aggrieved from the aggressor. That's all. But that he has to do. The interesting one begins to see, in simple psukim like this that we read over and over again, one begins to understand what is our obligation in situations such as that. And we begin to realize how far we've drifted from true Torah. A lot of the things the Torah does we keep very meticulously, but a lot of things the Torah tells us to do that we totally ignore. We are not permitted to tolerate redifa, to see unjust oppression. We're not permitted to tolerate. And in the days when South Africa was the place is viewed as a place of unjust oppression, I used to make the point, you remember, it's all very well fighting the system, but the system is not what you've got to fight. You've got to fight it when you see it. And people were being very brave fighting the system. But not only weren't they being brave fighting it when they saw it, they themselves did it. The very people who were fighting the system used to do it. It's not systems that have to be fought, it's people. If one sees a particular person taking advantage of another person, you can't say it's none of my business. It is your business. And one has to get involved. You don't have to discuss the morality of it. You don't have to discuss the justice of it. You don't have to punish anybody. That's not your business. But to help the person who's being aggrieved, that one has to do. You can't stand idly by. Moshe gets involved. That was the one case. Two non-Jews having an argument. Moshe decides who's the aggressor, who's the aggrieved, and he helps the aggrieved. Just before that, Vayetze Vayom Hasheni, he went out on the second day, V'inei Shnei Anoshim Ivrim Nitzim, and he saw two Jews arguing with each other. Dosum Vaviram they happened to be. Vayomer lo rosho, and again he picks out on the aggressor, on the wicked one, and he says to him, Lomo sakereyecho, why are you smiting your friend? So he doesn't act here. Here he educates. He doesn't get involved, he doesn't hit anybody, he doesn't punch anybody, he doesn't save anybody. He confronts the one side with a moral issue, with a moral question. Lomo sakereyecho, he's your friend. Why are you doing this to him? Explains the Sipurna. Mipnei heyos koil echod mehem echov. Since both of them were his brothers, loy his oire lazer. He wasn't moved to help one of them. Aval hachiach b'mishra, but he saw his role as an educator. That somebody is doing something wrong, somebody is conducting himself incorrectly, I need to educate. It's not my business to save one from the other. I don't know what's going on here, and they're both my brothers. There's no side for me to take. But there is a question of education. I've got to clarify what's happening. You're hitting him. Why are you hitting him? Is it justified? And then there's another case. On the first day he goes out in Mitzrayim, Vayar ish Mitzri make ish Ivri me'echo. He sees an Egyptian hitting one of his Jewish brothers, one of Moshe's Jewish brothers. So this is the third case. The case of Yisrael was a goy with a goy. The second case was a Jew with a Jew, and now it's a goy with a Jew. So you know the story. Vayifen koy v'choy, vayar ki ein ish. He turned one way and another way, saw there was nobody there. Vayach is ha-mitzri, and he smote the mitzri, killed him. Vayit meneyu b'choy, and he hit him in the ground. Buried him. Why does he do that? Why does he kill the Egyptian? So here we begin to cross racial boundaries. He has an Egyptian fighting with a Jew. Moshe the Jew gets involved and kills the Egyptian. Why? The Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Nun Ches Amud Beis, it's a strange halacha, and we're not going to go in this evening as to the reason for this halacha. But Omar Rabbi Chanina, Oyved Kechovim Shehiko Es Yisrael, Chayev Miso. If a non-Jew hits a Jew, he's guilty of the death. Of death, and that's it. You don't send him in a bus over the border and let him languish in the snow. You kill him. Finish. Just get rid of him. Shneimar, as it says, and what's the proof for that? Vayifen koy v'choy v'yar ki einish v'yachis ha-mitzri. We see that's exactly what Moshe did. What did this mitzri do? He hadn't killed a Jew. He had only smitten a Jew. And for that, Moshe Rabbeinu kills him. So you see from there that if a non-Jew kills a Jew, the non-Jew is chayev misa. The Rambam doesn't paskin that way. The Rambam paskins that he's chayev misa b'day shemayim. That God will extract a death penalty from him, but a beis din doesn't do that. Man, that's not a basis to kill a non-Jew merely for hitting a Jew, and the Kisef Mishnah explains where the Rambam gets that from. But let's analyze both according to the Gemara and according to the way the Rambam learns afterwards. According to the Gemara, that means the reason that Moshe hits him is Moshe is paskening. Moshe sees the situation, takes the law into his own hands, decides the psak is, the legal decision is that this Egyptian person is guilty of death, and Moshe executes the death sentence. That's how we would understand it. But according to the way the Rambam paskens, that he's not chayev miso b'dei odom, that a human being does not have the right to kill a non-Jew just because he smote a Jew. On what basis did Moshe carry out this death sentence? What right did Moshe have to kill the Egyptian just because the Egyptian had hit the Jew? Explains the Sipurna an amazing thing. Before we look at the Sipurna, let's look at Rashi. Rashi says, "Vayifin koy v'choy." What does it mean? He looked this way and he looked that way. Ro'o me'osoloy b'bayis u'me'osoloy basode. Moshe perceived what this man had done, what this Egyptian man had done to this person at home and in the field. And the previous Rashi gives us the story that this Egyptian had not only oppressed him, but he had called him out in the middle of the night so that he could go and seduce his wife. When the Jewish man realized what was happening, that's when he started molesting him in the field. So Vayifin Koy V'Choy means Moshe understood the whole story. He saw exactly what had happened. That there'd been a seduction or a rape, that there'd been molestation, that there'd been all sorts of terrible things taking place, both in the man's home and in the field, and this was intolerable. So he passed in mitzvah, he decided death. But then Rashi adds, Ulefi Pshutoi Kemashmoy. But the simple meaning of the Pasuk is literal. Vayifen koy v'choy, he looked this way and that way, saw that nobody was watching and killed the Egyptian. That means Vayifen koy v'choy does not mean an analysis of the reasons for which this was taking place. It means Vayifen koy v'choy was not an investigation into the circumstances. Vayifen koy v'choy just means he looked to see that nobody was watching. That's pshutei kemashmoi, says Rashi. And if that's the case, why did he kill him? Explains the Sipurna. Umitzad he'ochvo. He Yisra Lazar. Says the Sipurno, there's an extra word in this pasuk that says Vayar Ish Mitzri Make Ish Ivri, and Moshe saw an Egyptian man hitting a Jewish man. Should have stopped there. Me Echov, one of his brothers. Says the Sipurno, Umitzad Ha'achvo Yisra Lazar. He got involved because it was a brother. That was it. So what does that mean? So if somebody is hitting my brother, does that entitle me to kill him? Now, one of the things that we do in the processes in the business ethics situation is we take black people and English and Afrikaans people all together and I ask them what the rules of the company are. If you're aware of somebody stealing, what are you meant to do? So they tell me they're meant to report it. And I say, is that a condition of your employment? They say, yes. And I say, and if you fail to employ it, to report them, and that's illegal, and it's acting against the conditions of our employment. I say, fine. And I say, and therefore, if you see somebody stealing once, would you? So you better discuss the circumstances. If the first time a fellow steals, you see him stealing, first time he's stolen, what would you do? And usually we find that the white people say they would report it, and the black people say they wouldn't. Then I start discussing different situations, and I say, what would you do, say to the white people, what would you do if the person that you found stealing was your own brother, and he's very poor, and the creditors are busy taking away his house, and his wife died, and he's got 11 children, and he's going through a terrible time, and you can't help him, you're also not all that well off, and never he stole something to take home to eat, and it was your brother. Would you report it? So usually 99% of the cases, there's sometimes we have people who say yes, I would still report it. I would say, sorry brother, I have to do it, that's the conditions of my employment, that's the law, you shouldn't have done this, there's nothing I can do. But it's very, very few people who say that. Usually the answer is no. I know I should, I know the law requires that I do, I know it's a condition of my employment, but I wouldn't do that. If it was my brother, I would talk to him, I would explain to him, I would try and counsel him, I would try and persuade him to find other things, I would warn him of the dangers of doing it. Certainly not the first time, I certainly wouldn't report him, even though I know it's not the right thing to do. And they feel a bit disturbed about that, that they would actually act illegally and incorrectly because of their brother. So I ask them why, and they don't know why. They can't explain why. Why is it that you would act in a way that's illegal when in other circumstances you wouldn't, just because it's your brother? What difference does it make? And then I say, what if it's your cousin? Well, that's already a shady. Some say yes, some say the same, some say start changing. Second cousin, uncle, aunt. What if it's your father? Oh, that's a tough one already. If it's then there's no question they wouldn't do it. So what's it all about? Why is it like that? And then I go into a deep analysis of the different types of loyalty. What loyalty means, why we're loyal, why we're not loyal, when we're loyal, what happens when there's a conflict of loyalties. One loyalty demands that you do a particular thing, and there's another loyalty that demands that you do the opposite. And I speak to them about loyalty to yourself. And that loyalty to yourself comes first. That's the principle in the Gemara of Chayecho Koidmin L'Chayech Avercho. Your life comes first. You don't start making a cheshbon of which is the better life, which is the greater life. That doesn't come into it. When there's a question of saving your life or somebody else's life, your life comes first. That's accepted. And since it's accepted as part of human nature, it's accepted by the Torah, it's accepted also as being morally correct. That we're entitled to save ourselves first. And what do we do if we find ourselves in a situation where we're deserving punishment? Do we try and escape it? Of course we try and escape it. What do you do if you're any kind of situation? If you're caught speeding, what do you do when the policeman stops you? You say, yeah, speeding, I was going 25 kilometers an hour over the speed limit. What's the thing, please? You're quite right, go ahead. And please don't be lenient. Whatever the law requires, give it all to me. We don't. We try and get out of it. Why do we try and get out of it? Surely the right thing is, we know what the law is, we know what's correct. What's the argument? What's the discussion? No, we still try and get out of it. And if we've done something wrong and we're suffering physical pain as a consequence of that, don't we try and minimize the pain? Of course we do. You know, not supposed to eat certain things, so we go ahead and we eat them. And then when we feel the effect of it, what do? We don't say to ourselves, yeah, I deserve it, that's fine, it's okay. We go to the doctor, we try and find ways to ease the pain. We're not prepared to take the consequences, even of our own actions. Because Chayecha Kodmin, the first thing we're worried about is ourselves. And that's acceptable. There is such a morality. There is such an understanding of that. But one has to understand, how far do I go? When I talk about I come first, how big is the I? Is my father part of that I? Is my son part of that I? Is my brother part of that I? Where does that limit? Where do I stop that? Where do I feel sufficient identity with another person to act towards him as I would towards myself? If the mitzvah is beating me up, what do I do? Do I sit there and say, well, okay, maybe even the man did something wrong? After all, the mitzvah is the employer and the Jew is the worker. What would happen? What would happen, I ask myself, if we were working for a company that we don't identify at all with? If you were on contract to a company in a very foreign sort of country, in the Congo, working for in Libya, you're on contract working for a group of Arabs, and there's another Yid who's working there with you, and you're both struggling for a living, and he steals. What are you going to do? Go and tell the Arab bosses that your fellow Jew stole, and get him sacked? How many of us would do that? We wouldn't. So where does our loyalty go? Yet when a black person won't report his fellow black to us, we get all upset. Where's your loyalty? Look what I've done for you. We do exactly the same. So what is it? What decides when we do and when we don't? It's not a question of loyalty. It's simply a question of how far my identification with my friend goes. I wouldn't report my father, and I wouldn't report my child, and I wouldn't report my brother. What about my cousin? What about my second cousin? What about my fellow Jew? At what point do I say I no longer identify with him? So Jews identify with the Jewish people. Muslims identify with Muslims. Blacks identify with their fellow black people, in that sense. What about the Western world, the non-Jewish Western world? They don't identify with anybody outside their immediate family, and sometimes not even that. And that's why they can't understand it. So who's more moral? And I ask them this question. I say, is it more moral to see the I as including more people or less people? Who's the more moral person who sees, when I say I come first, and I means me and me only, is that more moral or less moral than the person who says I come first and I means my people? Which is the more moral one? The second one is the more moral. And then I have to turn around to the white people and I say, so do you realize what it is? It's not a question. You would do the same as the black person if it was your brother. Well, it's his brother. That's all that's different. He sees that as brotherhood, and that's more moral. And the Jews would do the same, and the Muslims would do the same. It's only you Western, non-Jewish people, non-Semitic Westerners, the B'nai Yefes, you're the only ones who don't have that feeling. And you're the immoral ones, not the other way around. You've got to expand your sense of identity. Then we have to deal with the question, what do we do about it? That doesn't solve any problems. It makes the problem worse, not better. But the first thing is to understand that the problem is not created by an immorality. The problem is created by two different perceptions of what morality is. Says the Sipunu, Umitzad ha'achvo his oirer la'azer. And that Sipunu is the source of that whole session that we do in the business ethics programs. And the business ethics, as a matter of interest, is simply taking the Motzei Shabbos shiurim and applying them to universal principles in the business world. That's all they are. It's the Motzei Shabbos shiurim working. That's all that it is. So in that case, Moshe goes out of a relationship to his fellow brother, to his brother. Which means what we see here, and this is the first chiddush that we have to understand in the concept of racial interrelationship, that's inside the race and beyond the race, is the breaking down of interpersonal barriers within the race, where the race sees itself as one family. That's very important. Not all races see themselves as one family. But where the race does see itself as one family, then there is a breakdown of the interpersonal relationships in the sense that the sense of identity, when I talk about me, when I talk about we, when I talk about us, I'm talking about the family. And the family means, in our case, all Jewish people, all people descended from Avraham Avinu, everybody has become part of that Jewish nation. That's the me, that's the us. And just as my family comes first, and just as anybody would put their family first, I will also put my family first. But my family is just a bigger family than other people's families. Not than all other people's. There are others who also have such large families. But we need to understand the system of the morality of putting another Jew first. Sometimes we're criticized for that. Sometimes we're admired for that. I met a non-Jewish professor of business ethics in the States when I was there now. And he's just written an interesting paper trying to show the advantages to business of high standards of ethics. And he does an interesting case. He examines what would happen to the efficiency of the diamond market in New York if you had to regulate it. If it was handled like other businesses are handled. Diamond market in New York are handled without contracts, without lawyers, without nothing. Just quick deals are done, and that's it. And millions of dollars worth of consignments are handed from one to the other on consignment, without a thing being signed even, nothing. One chosid would come to another one, I need this and that and the other, and put his hands in his pocket and pull out $500,000 worth of diamonds, and say, here, bring it back to me tomorrow. Sure, off he goes, that's the last you see. And goyim stand there in utter amazement, watching what's going on. And very often a goy will come up to the guy and say, do you know who that is? Do you know him? No, I'm not quite sure who he is. I've seen him around, I know, it's alright, it's okay, you don't have to worry. What do you mean it's okay? And if he disappears, he won't disappear. So this non-Jewish professor had written a paper working out economically what would happen to the efficiency of that market if you started saying, no, one second, no diamond may pass from one person to another without its weight and its size being recorded in detail and signed for by at least two signatures. And that document has to be written in three copies. One goes to him, one goes to him, and a third one goes to such and such a place. And when it's returned, you've got to do the reverse process. What happens if they instituted all that? The efficiency of the market, he works out actually in numbers what would happen to the efficiency of the market. Then he does the opposite. And he says, imagine what would happen in other markets if we could deregulate them totally, if you didn't need any of the legal business. If there was the level of trust that there is in the New York diamond market. Imagine what would happen in the property market. Imagine what would happen in all the different trades. And again, he does an exercise to work out economically, because there the Department of Business Ethics is part of the business school. In Seattle this was. He works out economically what would happen to markets, the enormous increase in efficiency of markets that would take place, and the enormous efficiency generally in economics that would take place if there were higher levels of trust. And he works out how much money is wasted, not only in frauds, but how much money is wasted in preventing frauds. If you didn't have to put that money into preventing frauds, what would happen to the efficiency of the market? So he was very admiring of the fact that when it comes to Jews, he understood. He said, I as a goy stand no chance. If I went to New York and I asked for diamonds on consignment, they would kick me out because I'm a goy. He said, I understand that. He said, that's incredible. That's the understanding. That's how the market, they will not have anybody in that market that is not a member of the family. That's lahavdil, how the mafia works. It's a different type of morality, and it's a different kind of business, but it's highly efficient. And it's not very regulated. Why? Because there's a family. That's it. It's understood. When there's a family, there is a level of ethics. Now you find it among the black people as well. They have these gambling systems, and they have these, what do they call them? The stock felt. They have all sorts of business things that they have, as deregulated as the New York diamond business is deregulated. And there was in fact a legal commission of inquiry that was spent months here, being asked by the government, headed by a couple of judges, to investigate whether to regulate the stock field industry and others. And they came up to the conclusion, no, don't touch it. It's one of the most efficient markets. It doesn't need regulations. Leave it alone. It's working well without regulations. When there's an understanding, when a family is dealing with each other as a family, you don't need lawyers, you don't need contracts, you don't need regulations. It's a different thing. That's achva. And the Jewish people have that, and other nations have that too. But it needs to be built upon, it needs to be developed, and it needs to be understood. That's what brings Moshe Rabbeinu to act. And he sees the other two arguing, the two Jews arguing. So here I don't have to get involved as a member of the family other than to educate. There's nothing for me to get angry about that this one's being aggrieved with. I don't know who's the one who's being aggrieved. Here there's a question of education. And so when Dosan and Aviram are arguing, he confronts them with the moral issue. Lomo sakerecho. Why are you doing this? What's it all about? What's happened here? He wants them to talk it out, so perhaps by talking it out, the matter will become clarified. And so he becomes involved as an educator. These are two of his own people. When it's two goyim that are fighting, when it's the non-Jewish shepherds are fighting with the non-Jewish shepherdesses, there he simply makes a decision who's the aggressor, who's the aggrieved, and he saves the aggrieved without getting involved in the philosophy of it and why are you doing it and is it right to do and is it moral to do. That he's not interested in. All he's interested in doing is saving the daughters of Yisroel, and that he does. But the important point that I wanted to make here was the fact that within the race, it is acceptable that the boundaries are removed and that one feels oneself as part of one family. What about across the race? Now we have interesting situations. One of them is Yisrael and one of them is Amalek. Amalek is one of the things that if one thinks about carefully, can cause one a lot of dismay and difficulty. The fact that the Torah commands us, the Rebbeinu Shlomo commands us to wipe out a nation. And what happens if there's some nice Amalekites? And what happens if it's 5,000 years after the event? Doesn't matter. Wipe them out. Strange, difficult for us to understand and to relate to that. And then to look at the relationship between Yisrael and Amalek. There was always a close relationship between Yisrael and Amalek. The first close relationship is the one we've just dealt with. That when Paro was deciding what to do with the Jewish people, who did he consult with? Yisrael and Amalek. They were always together, always working together. And years later, in the book of Shmuel, as we'll see, they were again together. They were always together. And yet, Amalek has to be wiped out, and Yisrael's people not. Not only must Yisrael's people not be wiped out, but the Ibn Ezra on our Sedra says that's the reason for placing the story of Yisrael right here. Really, he says this event took place after Matan Torah and should have been placed at the end of the Sedra or even later. But it's placed here immediately after the story of Amalek last week in order to create the contrast. Says the Ibn Ezra in the beginning of the Sedra. Now I shall explain why the parsha of Yisro is inserted in this particular position. Because of the evil which Amalek was recorded as having done against Yisrael, just being mentioned, his kir kenegdoi, the Torah now goes on to show the other extreme, the good that Yisrael did to Yisrael. And since it says before that we've got to undertake a war on behalf of God against Amalek, that the Jewish people are obligated to battle against Amalek when Hashem allows them to do so, the Torah mentions the words of Yisrael, because even if they're together with the nation of Amalek, that the Jewish people should always remember the chesed of their old grandfather Yisrael and not damage them and not harm them. So on the one hand, we're saying, we're quite stereotypical in saying any Amalekite we're wiping out. On the other hand, we're saying, but there's a part of that nation, there's a section, a subsection, or not part of the nation as such, but a nation that always worked together with the Amalekites, the descendants of Yisrael, them we don't touch. Let's look at it from Yisrael's point of view and then we'll come back to our point of view. Yisrael, we said, was a terrible anti-Semite. He wanted to wipe out all of the Jewish people. The daughters come along and tell him the story. Vatavoino el Ru'el avihen, and they came to Ru'el their father. Vayomer, and he said to them, Madua mihartem bo hayom, why are you so quick today? Why did you come so quickly? And they answer, Vatumano ish mitzvi yitzilonim yad haroim, an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. He lifted up the water for us, and he did all the work for us. He fed the flock. And Chazal tell us that in so doing, the daughters also told him that they saw the reason they were quick was because the water came up to Moshe. Moshe didn't have to bend down to the water. The water came up to Moshe. But Yisrael knew enough of history to realize that that wasn't the first time that that had happened, and that if this was the case, this couldn't have been a Mitzri. This must have been a descendant of Yaakov. This must have been a Jew. So he knows, although they thought he's an Egyptian, Yisrael now knows he's a Jew. Remember, Yisrael is a virulent anti-Semite who had instructed, who had advised Paro to annihilate the Jewish people. Now he has a situation where his daughters, not even knowing that it's a Jew, come and tell him they were helped by a Jew. What does he say? V'ayoyen, where is he? Lomo ze azavtim isoish. How could you leave him outside? Kiren aloy v'ayoy chalochim. Go back and call him so that he can join us to a meal. He sends them out to go back after him. And what we see in Yisrael is an interesting middah. Anti-Semite, yes, but he's not a stereotype. He's willing to look at the individual. He's willing to say, I don't like Jews, but Moshe, look what this one did. For that I owe him chesed. For that I owe him akoros atoiv. The fact that I don't like Jews, but what, he did something to help me. And he did something to help you girls. You've got to repay that. That understanding he had. And this was the start of Yisrael's shift, a shift which led him to become the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. A shift which led him to become not only a part of the Jewish people, but to make an incredibly important contribution to the Jewish people. And in fact to the legal system of the entire world. Because the system that Yisrael set up for the Jewish people was afterwards copied and used by all sorts of other nations and works till this day throughout the world. Yisrael's system. So Yisrael makes an enormous contribution to civilization as a result of this one point. Of willing to say, although and I'm an anti-Semite, I'm not interested. He has an individual who helped us. We've got to repay him with chesed. That's all. And what about Amalek? Amalek wiped out the old people, the young people, the babies, you remember, the weak people. When he came to war, the stragglers, the people who were left behind, who couldn't keep up, he went for them first. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is terribly angry about that. The Torah gets very angry about that. Why? What's the difference? It's war, after all. What's the difference? There's the enemy. What are you going to go? Choosing who you do kill, who you don't kill. The answer is that it's human to have sympathy on somebody who poses no threat to you, and in fact is in an unfortunate situation. It's not human, even in war, to go and shoot sick people, old people, babies. It's not human. So what can bring you to do that? The only thing that can bring you to do that is when you have dehumanized them to the point that you're not relating to them as human beings. It's very hard. The closer one gets to identifying with another being, the harder it is to act against that being. A small little insect we find we can get rid of. Even if it's not that irritating, certainly when it is irritating. To kill a mosquito, nobody has an enormous deal of difficulty with that. Nobody has a sleepless night with their conscience worrying them. Usually you find once you've killed the mosquito that's been irritating you, you get to sleep quite fast. You don't lie tossing and turning thinking about what you've done. But I spent the night in a hotel the other evening, whose name will remain unmentioned for the moment, and found an enormous cockroach in my room. But I found it very difficult to get rid of that fellow. He was already getting too big. This looked like a fellow, like somebody who was sharing my room with me already. This looked like I went through a lot of soul searching before I decided what to do with this individual. And if it were a mouse, also you don't hit a mouse on the head so easily. It becomes a little bit more of a situation. And if it's a cat, you certainly start having all sorts of moral conscience. You're going to shoot the cat. You find other ways of getting rid of the cat. And if it's another human being, certainly one doesn't do it. So in order to get rid of a thing, the first thing you have to do is to turn it into a mosquito. Into an irrelevant disturbance, irritation. Which, if you remember correctly, is what Hitler did with the Jewish people. The first thing you do is just turn them into mosquitoes. They're irrelevant and irritable. That's all they are. Get rid of them. If you view them like that, you've got to stereotype them, you've got to caricature them. It's interesting that I'm told that when they do research with animals, the first thing they do is they give the animals numbers, because you've got to refer to the animals, and they won't let the workers give the animals names. Because once you've given the animal a name, they say they find it very difficult to do what they have to do. So the first thing you've got to do is give the animal a number, which is the same technique that Hitler used. In order to enable his people to find no difficulty in doing what they had to do, the first thing they had to do is stop calling people by names, use numbers, dehumanize them, stereotype them into unimportant irritations, and then it doesn't matter. You don't look at the mosquito and think, is this a father mosquito or a mother mosquito or a baby mosquito? Is it old? Is it sick? Does it have dependents? Doesn't it have dependents? It's irrelevant. You just go for it. And so it is, once you've classified and stereotyped even human beings into an irrelevant irritation, you can get rid of them. The only way that Amalek could do what he did must be because he had decided Jews are nothing. Jews are unimportant. Jews can be annihilated. Jews are an irritation. That's it. Absolute stereotype. It makes no difference whether you're a good Jew or a bad Jew, an old Jew or a young Jew, a sick Jew or a healthy Jew. It makes no difference. Annihilate the whole lot of them. We see from Amalek's doings right at the beginning when he advises Paro, and here's where Yisrael and Amalek diverge. Amalek retains that inability to separate and to look at a human being as a human being. Yisrael doesn't. When he talks about the nation, he says, annihilate them. But when he meets a fine Jew, he says, 1 second, I owe chesed. That opens the door of humanity. Once you're willing to look at people like that, one can move away from the stereotype altogether. So the next point we're making here is the importance of, although we inevitably stereotype, and that's the way we deal, you can't stop it. And one shouldn't stop it, because you can't deal with, I don't know how many people there are in the world at the moment, 500 million, is that what it is? Anybody know how many people there are in the world? At last? 3,000 million, how many is that? It's gone up a little, 3,000 million is the figure that Stan suggests. 6,000 million. 6,000 million people. Well, you can't say, I relate to each one of them as an individual. So we do think of the Chinese, and we think of the Japanese, and we think of the Americans, and we think of the French, and the Italian, and the Africans, and so on. We do stereotype, and we classify people, and we start relating to them as nations. Now, obviously we're going to do that. But we have to have the ability to see beyond that when we're dealing with an individual, not to deal with him as a Chinese, or an American, or an African, or a Brazilian, or whatever we're going to do, but to actually be able to see him as an individual within the context of his nation, within the context of his culture, but be able to relate to him as an individual, as Yisrael did. The last thing I want to look at is the fact that years and years later we're still obligated to wipe out Amalek. And likewise, years and years later, we are still obligated to show Hakoros HaTov to Yisrael. In chapter 15 of Shmuel Aleph, Kli Omar Hashem Tzvokos, Shmuel comes to tell Shaul, so says Hashem, Pokadati es Asher Oso Amalek. This is in the time of Shmuel Hanovi, generations later. All of a sudden, Hashem comes on and says, oh, I haven't forgotten about Amalek. These people living now as Amalekim, they've had no dealings with Israel. There's been no antagonism. There's been no anti-Semitism. They've been living peacefully alongside them. Says Hashem, I haven't forgotten what they did to the Jewish people on their way back from Mitzrayim. Ato, now is the time. Lech v'yikisu es Amalek. Go and destroy them. V'acharamtem es kol asher lo. Go and destroy everything that is theirs. V'leisachmo el olov and show no mercy. V'himato me'ish adisho. And go and destroy them, man and woman. May oilil vad yonek, every little baby that you find. Mishur vad se, the oxen and the sheep. Don't worry what the environmentalists say. You go and get them. Migom vad chamor, every camel, every donkey. Imagine if that would happen today. Rabbi Shlom would come along and say, I'll tell you who the Amalekim are. Imagine even if he said it was the Germans. How easy would it be for him to say, okay, don't worry about the United Nations. Don't worry about America. Just go in there and clean them out. Every one of them. Man, woman, child, old, young, babies, animals, dogs, cats, everything. You just kill them. Imagine. How easy would that be for us? And if it wasn't the Germans? Comes along and says it's the British. Or he says it's the Americans. Or it's the Italians. Who knows who they are? Can, wipe them out. What would we, how would we handle that? Why? We were then called to the United Nations to explain what we're doing. Well, you know, a long time ago we had an argument with these people. It was 4,000 years ago. And they came along, and you know who they killed? They killed our little children and the old people. And they said to us, when exactly? When did you say this was? We'll say 4,000 years ago, a long time ago, we acknowledge, but we don't forget these things. It doesn't seem to make sense to us. But look also what happens. So Shaul gets ready. Shaul motivates the people. He gets 200,000 people ready, and off he goes. Vayovoy Shaul ad ir Amalek, and Shaul and his army come to the city of Amalek. Vayomer Shaul el Hakeni, and before he starts cleaning up, he addresses the Keni. Who are the Keni? Says Rashi, Bnei Yisrael, the children of Yisrael, but many generations later. And he says to them, Lechu suru rudu mitech Amaleki, get out of the way, clear out of the Amalekites. Pen oisifchoy moy, lest I will kill you with them. And you did kindness to all of Bnei Yisrael when they were coming out of Mitzrayim. I wouldn't want to kill you. So we have the two next to each other. It's not just the vengeance. It's the Hakoros HaToiv as well. And we've got to see that always. We've got to see that side by side. That on the one hand, the Jewish people are obligated to remember what Amalek did to us, but on the other hand, we've also got to remember what Yisrael did to us and others. And what was this wonderful that Yisrael did to all the Jewish people? Explains Rashi, Shenenu misudosoi, Moshe v'Aaron v'chol zikne Yisrael, because he gave a meal, and Moshe and Aaron, all the elders, benefited from that. Barei ma'ale olav kilo also chesedim kol bnei Yisrael. If one does kindness to the leaders, it's as if everybody has benefited. So it's an enormous chesed that Yisrael did, and we owe him a hakoros hatoiv. What is this business of owing people a debt of gratitude for something that their great, 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 great grandfathers did? I explained to you the difficulty that Westerners have in understanding that when I talk about I'm not just talking about myself, but I'm talking about my brothers too, and I'm talking about my cousins too, and I'm talking about my third and fourth and fifth cousins. I'm talking about my whole mishpoch. And my mishpoch is the whole Jewish people. That's who I mean when I say I. When I say we, that's what I mean. And Westerners find that difficult to understand, the removal of the barriers between people. But there's another thing Westerners find difficult, and that is the removal of the barriers between generations. The understanding of the continuity of generations. Now sometimes Westerners find that difficult. They find it difficult in the sense of families. But they don't find it difficult as a concept. For example, if I come along to Anglo-American Corporation and I show them a document that 80 years ago I lent them some money and they haven't yet repaid it. And it's time for them to pay up. And they say, yeah, when was this? 80 years ago? Sorry, that wasn't us. I wasn't even born. The person I'll go to there, the clerk, said, this is not me. 80 years ago, I wasn't around here. Take me to your boss. And so you go back and you go back. Eventually you get to the top people, and they say, look, forget it. This wasn't us. We're young people. You're coming here with something 80. It wasn't you either. It was your grandfather. So you want to say it was Harry Oppenheimer's father, lent your, or borrowed from your great-grandfather, and now you're coming to claim from it? We say, yes, Anglo-American is Anglo-American. What's the difference? In business, we understand that the identity transfers from generation to generation. It can be sold, it can be bought and sold, it doesn't matter. It's still Anglo-American. But when it's families, we can't understand that. We understand in business that a company is responsible for its actions, no matter how long afterwards, if there's still a legal responsibility, and no matter who's in charge of it. It doesn't matter that somebody else is now in charge. The liabilities and the assets of the business go to the new owners. But in families, we don't realize that. We know what it is. A child inherits from a father. That's fine. To inherit all the good things, we understand. But that he inherits the responsibilities as well. And if it can go from one generation, why not to two, and to three, and to four generations? This idea that because it happened a long time ago, we must forget about it, that's not a Jewish idea. The passage of time does not change the morality of the issue. The passage of time does not change the justice of the issue. The only thing the passage of time does is it changes the emotions. But if the original action was not based on emotions, then time does nothing. If we have to wipe out Amalek because we were angry with him, then as time passes, that anger decreases. But if we have to wipe out Amalek because they did something deserving of being wiped out, then their great-great-great-grandchildren have no right to be alive today. They ought to have been wiped out generations ago. They have a debt to pay. And the debt they have to pay is with their lives. And what has time got to do with that? The fact that we haven't been able to get that debt paid until now, what has that got to do with it? That's a company. And the company has a debt. And that debt will have to be paid. That's the concept. That's the understanding of being able to pass something on from generation to generation. We can't look at small time frames. We've got to look at very wide time frames. And that's why we've got the converse as well. Yisroel does a chesed. Does that mean it's the end of it? No. From Yisroel's chesed, we all benefited then, and we all continue to benefit today. And if we're continuing to benefit from Yisroel's chesed, we continue to owe him something. And if we come across Yisroel's great, 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 however many great grandchildren, we have an obligation towards them, just as we would have had to their old Zayda. Because we're still benefiting from that. That benefit, we have an indebtedness to them. And that indebtedness also passes down through the generations. They've got a debt to collect from us. And that doesn't finish just because one generation has passed on. That continues. And so in looking at the way we relate inside a race and across the race, we find some interesting things from these few observations. Number one, within the race itself, we're a mishpocha, we're a family. And we relate as such. Number two, when it comes to cross-racial relationships, while of course we classify, we have to be careful to be able to look at an individual within that classification and to relate to him as an individual, not to relate to him as a class. And to be able to redefine our understanding of the class of people as we relate to more and more individuals within that class. And the third thing we need to understand is that nations and races are not bound by the limitations of generations. One lifetime terminates with the death of the person who was living. But as long as the nation exists, the lifetime of that nation does not terminate with the death of anybody. As long as that nation exists in full life. And what the nation did 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, if it's the same nation, if it's descendants of the same people, they need to be rewarded for the fine actions. We need to respond to them with hakoros hatoiv for great deeds, and we need to extract justice where it's necessary for areas where they harmed us and where they caused us difficulty and problems. And that's something that one has to appreciate in all the areas that we act, and to understand even our feelings for the Holocaust, that part of our feelings that are emotionally based, yes, with time that gets easier. As time goes on, we find that a little bit easier to handle. But the injustice of it, the immorality of it, the wickedness of it, that doesn't get easier with time. That makes no difference. And that's something that the German people have inherited. And it's not something they can get rid of and say, but it wasn't us. It was you. It was you as a nation. And it remains you as a nation. And that never changes. You're never going to get rid of that. And just as we owe debts of gratitude to those nations or to those individuals who've done us chesed, so we need to understand and to remember where we stand with those people that have treated us and handled us in different ways. We need to understand clearly, that never gets forgotten, that never gets pushed aside, and that we need to know, that we need to appreciate. And those are some of the areas that need to be dealt with, and I've just touched on them this evening to open them up. The understanding that on first outlook, Amalek and Yisroel, and the people of Yisroel, the Keni, seem to be together. It was Yisroel and Amalek that sat together and that advised Paro in the annihilation of the Jewish people. And years later, when Shmuel is instructed to wipe out the Amalekites, he's about to do so and would wipe out the descendants of Yisroel at the same time because they continued to live together and to interact together. But the reason we're wiping Amalek out is not because of who they are. The reason we're wiping Amalek out is because of actions they did. And if it's because of actions they did, we've got to look at the descendants of Yisroel and the actions that they did. And we need to relate to people not on the basis of who they are, but on the basis of what they do. on the basis of what they have done, and to see and then to understand. When the actions are great, they need to be responded with greatness. And when the actions are negative, destructive, harsh and cruel, they need to be reacted with a sense of justice as well. They need to be reacted to with a sense of justice as well. All the time bearing in mind that there is a difference between an individual and a nation. And yet, the picture of the nation, the model of the nation, is the model of the family. A family doesn't end with the death of any of its members. The family continues. And the family doesn't consist of individuals completely insulated from one another. The family consists of people who are all closely related to one another and see one another as part of their own ego, as part of their own selves. And that's the sense of achva, that's the sense of brotherhood within Klal Yisrael. And it is for that reason that Moshe Rabbeinu, on seeing the Egyptian killing his brother, gets involved, as the Sipurna says, not out of the justice of it even, and not out of the rights and wrongs of it even, but for one simple motivation, that is, he defends his brother just as he would defend himself. And if the defense of his brother entailed the killing of the Egyptian, then so be it, that has to be done. There was no way he was going to tolerate that injustice for his brother. That's the responsibility that we have one for another. That's the love that we have one for another.